Our enemy is not terrorism, because terrorism is but a tactic. Our enemy is not terror, because terror is a state of mind. And as Americans, we refuse to live in fear. Nor do we describe our enemy as jihadists or Islamists, because jihad is a holy struggle, a legitimate tenet of Islam.
A legitimate tenet of Islam. Oh, geez. That was a clip of just another one of those Muslim moderates demonstrating his moderation, praising Hamas, the alien being in the chest of the Muslim Brotherhood. Welcome to all of you in the chat. We're so glad to have you with us, especially Helen Thomas. And here to speak with us on this very subject of so-called Muslim moderation and his new book, we are blessed to have with us accomplished author Andrew McCarthy, distinguished guest, the author of his best-selling book, The Grand Jihad, How Islam and the Left Sabotage America. Mr. McCarthy is a senior fellow at the National Review Institute in Washington, a contributing editor of National Review, and the author of an earlier work, another bestseller, Willful Blindness. We're so glad to have him with us. That book is a memoir. Willful Blindness is a memoir of the successful prosecution of the perpetrators of the 93 bombing. And Mr. McCarthy, thank you for being here with us.
Hi, Andy. How are you?
Thank you, Andy. It's a pleasure to hear from you. Having read your book, and I cannot recommend it enough to everyone, as well as Willful Blindness, I had the same dilemma with your book that I had with Liberty and Tyranny and that Mark Levin's book, and that was I'd come to a great point and say to myself, that's the best point. That's my favorite. That's it. And then 2 pages later, that's the best point.
Very. I can't be flattered enough to be compared to my buddy Mark Levin, who Liberty and Tyranny is just an extraordinary book, and I must tell you, I had the same experience that you did. Every time I thought he had hit the high note, he topped himself.
Well, you did the same thing, and your book, and everybody needs to get it. I'm not just kissing butt here. Everybody needs to get it. It needs to be on your coffee table with Liberty and Tyranny, America Alone, and perhaps liberal fascism as well. It's just a necessary book. And all books should have that problem as having too many high points. It seems that literally, if I have to make a bumper sticker of your book, here in The Grand Jihad, it seems that you're making the case, literally, that on my bumper sticker it would say, Islam equals jihad equals Sharia. Did I get that right?
Well, I think close. I mean, I think what I'm trying to explain to people, or at least relate from my experience of it, I don't purport to be a comparative religion scholar or anything of the sort, but I don't think that there's any credible way to deny that there's a connection between Islamic doctrine, which is drawn from the Quran and the other Islamic scriptures, and both terrorism committed by Muslims who accurately cite passages in the scriptures when they as justification for their atrocities, and also what I write about the book and I hope people take away from it, which is the fact that there's a broader, as they put it, civilizational threat to our society, which is based on what I would argue is a very mainstream interpretation of Islam. So whether the problem is Islam or Islamism, in either event, jihad is absolutely a legitimate tenet and a mandatory tenet of Islam, and the mission of jihad is always and everywhere to spread Sharia, which means that they can do it by violence, they can do it by nonviolence and sabotage, which is what they say their strategy is, but they're always trying to implement Sharia, which is the Islamic law and which is deemed in Islamist ideology to be the necessary precondition to Islamicizing a society. And I think we really need to underscore and understand that they have every intention of trying to Islamicize this society. That's, in fact, the title of the book, The Grand Jihad, is not something I came up with like a, you know, a mad scientist bouncing around in my attic here. It's actually, you know, something that I quoted from an internal Muslim Brotherhood memorandum from 1991, where the leadership of the International Muslim Brotherhood in America reports to the global leadership in Egypt that the movement in America sees their work as what they call a grand jihad to eliminate and destroy Western civilization by sabotage. That's their words that I'm quoting. It's not me figuring out that that's what they're up to.
Right. It's their own leadership that uses these terms. These are not
exactly right
things that we pulled out of the air.
Right. And I, you know, I think we ought to take them at their word. The thing, Pat, that really has made me a little crazy, I guess, since the book has come out, and I suppose I shouldn't have been surprised by this because I've heard the same sort of thing for a number of years. But, you know, a lot of people don't want to argue with me about whether this is what they really say or not. You know, after all, how could they? I mean, this is there's documentary evidence that they said it. This is not me making it up, and I don't even even the worst apologist isn't going to accuse me of fabricating the evidence. So what they instead do is, you know, they're dismissive of it. They just say, oh, well, you know, it's purple rhetoric. It's chest beating. It really doesn't mean anything. And, you know, number one, I guess, you know, even if I didn't know what I've learned over the last almost 20 years of dealing with this, I would be a little bit taken aback by the fact that, you know, a group thought that that sort of rhetoric, even if they didn't mean it, was going to be something that was going to put them in good light among millions and millions of people. But the other thing that occurs to me is that they do mean it, and if you take it from, you know, forget about whether Western apologists for Islamists think they're serious or not. If you look at the world from their point of view, from the Islamist point of view, the Soviet Union, the great superpower, is no more. And in Islamist lore, it was defeated and humiliated by the Afghan Mujahideen. The World Trade Center, the Twin Towers, iconic symbols of Western economic might, are, you know, a gigantic crater in lower Manhattan now, which, it, you know, from my perspective, as you know, when I drive past, it continues to haunt us, haunt the city, haunt our country. There's a lot of places where it doesn't seem to have had the resonance or have the resonance that it had at one time, but it's still very meaningful to a lot of us.
You know, we used to use an expression, I haven't heard it for a while, maybe for obvious reasons, used to use an expression when you were being self-deprecating, and it was loaded with sarcasm, I don't need a building to fall on me. Well, we've just had several buildings fall on us.
Right.
And yet, we still don't get it.
No, and we don't get that they really think they're going to win. You know, I mean, they look at history, and they see it trending in their direction. There's been almost no attention to the fact that this flotilla incident about 2 weeks ago now, the incident itself has had a lot of attention, and of course there's been, you know, a lot of condemnation of Israel and a lot of, from our side, well-placed, I think, arguments that, you know, what do you expect Israel to do? They're confronted by an obvious, transparent provocation, which was, you know, intended to have exactly the result that it had so that they could be condemned by the international community, which is exactly what's happened. But, you know, lost in all of this, it seems to me, is the fact that Turkey is now back in the Islamist fold. I mean, the terrorists who carried out this flotilla, this peace flotilla, as they called it, were Turkish Islamist terrorists who were acting on behalf of Hamas, a terrorist organization that's been designated as a terrorist organization in American law for, you know, about 15 years. And I think that we've missed the significance of that to Islamists. But the Muslim Brotherhood actually began as a reaction to Ataturk's program in Turkey to purge Islam from the public square and basically to suppress Sharia. From the Islamist perspective now, they've not only like destroyed the Soviet Union and knocked down the Twin Towers and attacked the Pentagon, they've brought Turkey back into the fold after 80 years of battle to try to do exactly that. You know, we're kind of
and Ataturk's what he was trying to do was a reaction to clean up the country, kind of, after the Armenian genocide and such.
Well, what I think he was really trying to do was, and it's telling that he felt this way because he actually himself was a Muslim, but he decided that what was holding the Islamic world back and what was holding Turkey in particular back and what would prevent it from becoming yet again a great country that could compete with the West was Islam. And he thought that the only way that he'd be able to move his country into modern times was to adopt the West's view that there should be a separation between secular life and religious life. And that's unnatural to Islam, but he tried to do it. And the only way you could do it was to really repress Islam. And that's what he tried to do. And Hassan al-Banna, who was the guy who created the Muslim Brotherhood in 1928, was so outraged by Ataturk's repression of Islam that he was actually moved to create the Muslim Brotherhood. And they've had this interesting duel, these 80 years. And I regret to say that, you know, what we've seen in the last 2 weeks, it looks like Banna's vision finally had its victory over Ataturk's vision, which ought to make us all a little bit fearful.
The timing of your book with the advent of the building of the mosque, that announcement couldn't have been more apropos. And it seems fairly obvious that these mosques on Staten Island and Long Island and as well are the standard attempt at humiliation. It seems to be a tool in the toolbox that is used to bring about Sharia. Would you agree with that?
Well, yeah, I think that one of the strategies, you know, Banna taught that especially when the Islamic forces were not militarily able to compete with their enemies, that the most important battles would be the propaganda battles, the battles in the court of public opinion, and so on. And one of the ways that Sharia is advanced, one of the ways that the Islamist movement is advanced, has always been to build their icons on top of the icons of the peoples who they either have conquered or are intending to conquer. And it's remarkable to think that not only have the World Trade Center towers been felled, which by itself it has been a tremendous not only a military but propaganda victory for the greater Islamist movement to have knocked those towers down. But now the thought that we haven't been able to build the towers back up, but they're going to build a mega mosque that towers over what is now a big empty crater where the Twin Towers used to stand, is just a tremendous propaganda victory for them. And it's unbelievable that the argument for it, the rationale for why we have to have this mosque, is offered in the rhetoric of tolerance. If you were to go to Mecca or Medina, you not only wouldn't see a Christian church or a Jewish synagogue, you wouldn't see anything because you're a non-Muslim. You wouldn't be allowed in the cities. They're closed cities. And this isn't an Al-Qaeda gambit. This is the Saudi kingdom enforcing a dictate of the Quran that essentially says that non-Muslims are not fit even to set their feet down on the ground in these Islamic holy sites. By contrast, we in the United States have permitted the construction of over 2,300 mosques throughout our country. There are a couple of hundred mosques in the New York area. We permit that even though we know about three-quarters of the mosques are actually dominated by this Islamist ideology that's virulently anti-American, and yet we're supposed to understand that it's we who are intolerant if we don't allow the mosque, which is just, I mean, it's not only, you know, preposterous on its face, it's kind of an insult to common sense.
It seems like when you speak about Americans' reaction to what's going on being intolerant, it seems that creating this atmosphere of PC language, etc., over the last decades has been really the left softening the ground for such a thing.
Well, as I argue in the book, the left does work with the Islamists. I've been surprised in the interviews I've done since the book came out that people want to argue with me about what, you know, they basically say, well, why would the left do that? You know, because they have as much to lose from the Islamists as anyone else does. And, you know, my reaction to that has kind of been to say, well, you know, look, the left does do it. You know, I mean, it seems kind of silly to argue that something, you know, as a hypothesis that something wouldn't happen when, in fact, it's actually happening before our eyes.
And, in fact, the left seems to think that they're going to, as someone in the chat says, the left seems to think that they will somehow be immune to the impact of Sharia if and when it comes to be. Why? How could they?
Well,
they make this mistake over and over again.
Right. Well, Winston Churchill said that the you know, basically the definition of an appeaser is you know, someone who hopes that the crocodile will eat him last. And the history of the interaction between Islamists and leftists, and I'm talking now about, in terms of Islamists, we're talking about people who want to install Sharia law, and with respect to leftists, we're talking about the hard left in America and elsewhere. The history of their working together has been that they combine when they have a common enemy, but that doesn't, you know, these arrangements are mergers, are alliances, not mergers. It's not like their contradictions and their differences with each other go away. And if it gets down to just the two of them, they absolutely do fight to the death with each other. So, for example, in the 50s, the socialists under Nasser partnered up with the Muslim Brotherhood to take out the monarchy. But once the monarchy was gone, the two fought with each other until finally Nasser and the secular government in Egypt brutally repressed the Muslim Brotherhood. The opposite result happened in the 70s and early 80s when the communists in Iran aligned with Khomeini to take out the Shah, after which the Shah brutally repressed the communists, so that the Islamists came out ahead on that one. But I think each side is always confident that if it gets down to brass tacks, they'll be able to overcome the other side. But what makes them work together is the fact that they have a common enemy that makes their differences between themselves appear to be relatively small. And in America, in the United States, the common enemy they have is our freedom culture, our American constitutional republicanism based on individual liberty. If people are free to make their own decisions and run their own lives, neither the Sharia agenda nor the left agenda can work. So they need to take out that freedom culture in order to impose their respective utopias. And if they ever get rid of us, the freedom culture, I have no doubt that they would fight each other fiercely.
We are speaking with Andy McCarthy, author of The Grand Jihad. Would you say, or I believe I understood correctly, that you believe that the war on terror is actually distracting us from the greater jihad, which is happening here at home, Have I got that correct?
Well, I do think that the I think it's fair to say that the vibrant debate in Islamist circles these days, and that when we're talking about Islamists, we're talking about everybody who wants to impose a Sharia society, not only the terrorists like Al Qaeda who want to do it in a sort of direct and rapid way, but also the broader jihadist Sharia movement, which would like to see Sharia imposed, even if they wouldn't commit terrorism to make that happen. The real debate in that community these days is whether Al-Qaeda terrorism in the United States has outlived its usefulness. And what I mean by that is not to say that the Muslim Brotherhood, which is really the vanguard of the Islamist movement, it's not to say that they're anti-terrorism, because they're not. They support terrorism when they think tactically it advances the ball. They oppose it where they think that the blowback effect is a negative for them. And what their argument is with respect to Al-Qaeda in the United States, as opposed to, say, in Iraq or Afghanistan, where they support Al-Qaeda, but when we're talking about attacks in the United States, what I think they would say is, and what they do say is, that they have spent three generations going back to the early 1960s building up an Islamist infrastructure in the United States, beginning with the Muslim student societies or Muslim student associations that they started in the early 60s, and there are now over 600 of those in North America. But what they would say is that they are having such a good time, they are making such progress marching through our institutions, getting accommodations throughout the West, getting Sharia law legitimized here and there, that terrorist attacks in the United States are at this point almost counterproductive, because it's the terrorist attacks that wake the sleeping giant of the American people to the fact that there is this global jihadist movement, and it's when the United States people, when the American people are raised up like that, that is when there's a blowback effect and there's pushback against the advance of Sharia. I think they'd rather quietly go about it without terrorist attacks.
Changing gears only slightly, you've talked about, many people have mentioned Cordova House, the choice of that word, the brazenness, as the nuns used to say, the bold brazenness of Cordova House, the term Cordova House for the giant mosque. And is that not an enormous clue as to what they have in mind?
Yeah, I've been saying it's got all the subtlety of a sledgehammer. You know, Cordoba was the name of the caliphate that conquered Spain and ruled it often brutally for over half a millennium. I would say it's kind of an enormous clue of what they're trying to accomplish by having the mosque there.
And we have had the privilege of speaking with Annie McCarthy, author of his new book, The Grand Jihad, which is on both the New York Times bestseller list as well as the Amazon bestseller list. And you can buy it there, and you need to read the evidence that he presents. He builds the case about what we have to fear from Islam and the building of these mosques as well. And we thank him so much for being here. And Andy, anytime, our door is always open to you. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Pat. Appreciate it.